Mr. Condren, reel 7. You mentioned Alan Winnington.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me how you first came into contact with him and what kind of an impression he made?
Well, the very first time he came to the camp, I didn't like him much. I hadn't spoken to him. I didn't like what I saw. He struck me as being a very arrogant person. He was much better dressed, certainly, than we were. He had a Chinese uniform on, a fur hat, and whatnot. And then when I first spoke to him, my initial impressions of him being arrogant and so on were increased. I still got this feeling.
In what way did he appear?
I don't know, because Winnington had this kind of air of being a very superior Englishman sort of thing, which I didn't like.
You mean upper crust?
I don't know. I don't think he thought himself as being sort of upper crust, but he had this sort of way, I don't know, he was, I suppose, middle class English, but he had this air of superiority about him, and he tended to be looking down upon everyone around him. That was my initial impression. I didn't mind so much the fact of him being a communist. That was probably neither here nor there, because I figured that people have the right to believe what they believe in. Because when I first met him, although I had become interested in things, I was in no way, I was going to say I was in no way committed. I've never been in any way committed. To me it's been an intellectual, or it certainly was at that time an intellectual exercise more than anything else. We invited Winnington to, our company invited Winnington to come and give us a talk on, because I think the armistice negotiations were going on at that time. And we had bits and pieces of news, but we didn't really know what was going on, and we didn't always believe what the Chinese were telling us, or what the Chinese, we occasionally got a Chinese newspaper called the Shanghai News, which was an English, a paper in English. We called it the Shanghai Liar, because we didn't believe anything we read in it. And we didn't believe much of what we'd been told about the armistice negotiations as to how things were progressing and so on. And we invited Winnington to give a talk or a lecture on it. And to this talk, most of the camp turned up, in actual fact. It wasn't just a British company. Initially, as far as I remember, it was a British company that had asked him. But many of the Americans also turned up. And he told us some things which we believed, some things which we didn't believe, some things which later on the whole, we found to be true.
Such as?
Well, the way the negotiations were going. He said that, basically, he said that the Americans were stalling the negotiations, and that the Chinese were making, or the Chinese and the North Koreans were making suggestions and so on, which could have brought the events to a speedier conclusion, but that the Americans were holding up the negotiation. We didn't believe that at first. We tended to see the American side as striving very hard at negotiations to get release for us chaps that were in the prisoner of war camp. Again, you tend to take a very one-sided viewpoint of things if you're in a bad situation. You don't necessarily look at the overall political or military situation. You tend to see it just from your point of view. We didn't think the Americans were such rotters as to do that, so we didn't believe. But later on, we came across other information which tended to reinforce this, that it was the case in some ways. I'm not saying altogether. He was also able to give us some news of home, and so. But these things weren't of any great importance. The most important thing, and I think the most important role that Winnington played, as far as we in the prisoner of war camp were concerned, was that he was a channel through which that, you know, we could. He could put pressure on the Chinese. He got us things like razor blades. Books, records, later on even got us a gramophone. He was instrumental in doing this, I suppose mainly because of his position with the Chinese, where he could go and say that, well, you know, I think it would be good if the chap's got this, and whereas the Chinese might say, I don't know, but for instance, if we ask the Chinese for, say, some of the English classics, the Chinese might think, oh, no, this might be bad, you know, and they'd have to vet it politically and all the rest of it. Whereas if Willington said, then they had confidence in his judgment and so on, so they'd do it. And I'm sure that's how we got a lot of the... we weren't inundated with stuff, but relatively speaking, it was something instead of nothing. I think Willington did a lot of good in that way. He was accused at the end of the war of, you know, having brainwashed people and things like that. As far as I know, he never did. As far as I know, I mean, people have claimed to have been interrogated by Willington, but I don't know. Again, it might be true, but I shouldn't have thought that Willington was such a fool as to do something like that. I mean, as a British citizen. Because at some time later he comes home, he's got to face the music on that one. But again, I don't know. He might have got a bit carried away, a bit excited. I don't know.
When Winnington came amongst you, was it on an informal or a formal basis? I mean, would he turn up to a lecture or just...
Both. He came and I think that first time he came and gave us a lecture, that was, we sort of all went up. We had a hall sort of made and built. And we went there and he came in and talked to us. And then afterwards he came back down the company with us. He just walked, there were no Chinese around, he just came and walked around. There were some people in the camp who didn't talk to him, who saw him as a communist and didn't like him therefore and didn't talk to him. But I think the majority sort of chatted with him if he wanted to. Because the other thing he did was he took lists of names and numbers and so on and let people know that we were all right. He took mail for us. And some of the first letters that we know that got back home, it was again due to Winnington. There was a case where sometimes we didn't get much mail anyway, but for a long time we didn't get anything, and we knew our families were writing. And it wasn't long after Winnington's first visit when we got quite a lot of mail, so I'm sure he had something in that too. Why the Chinese were holding it up, or what, I don't know. The Chinese argument was, oh, your mail must have got lost, it got bombed, and so on, but I don't think it was always the truth. I just don't think the Chinese understood the importance, if you're a prisoner of war, or in that sense, you know, of getting mail from home. I just don't think they understood. It didn't come across the mind.
What, do you remember when Winnington came to you?
When? The exact time?
Yes.
No, I'm afraid not.
Or which year?
You could probably find it. There's certainly books. His own book, you know, this Breakfast with Ma, he might mention it in there. Let me think. It must have been 1952, I should say. Probably about the beginning or middle of 52. Because when he came, things had improved. You know, our living conditions and so on had improved. So that really didn't happen until, well, certainly after the end of 51, or even later.
Did your attitude towards him change after you found him arrogant to start off with?
Yes, I suppose it did. I found that he was a reasonable sort of person. But he always was a little bit arrogant, Alan, anyway. I mean, later on, particularly after I went to China, I got to know him quite well. And I've even told him to his face, I think you're a bit arrogant sometimes, Alan. So that initial impression was moderated, but never really changed. And other people have said this too. I don't know if he was actually, or whether he just gave this impression.
How did he respond when you said it to his face?
He just laughed. I think he said something to the effect, oh, you might be right, you know. Because I don't think he missed it either. But he was a clever man, and to me, he was always a very reasonable man. Had his own views, he had his own points of view as to, you know, things were going.
What about Wilfred Burchett? Did you come across him?
Burchett, I saw a couple of times in the camp, but not. He didn't. Uh, he, think he came to our camp only once, whereas Winnington and I came, I think, came maybe about three times. But we didn't see much of Burchett. I didn't know Burchett all that well.
Did you get any impression of him as a person?
Tended to like him a bit more. He was a bit more down to earth than, or he seemed to be a bit more down to earth than Winnington was. More sort of one of us, if you like, you know. Why, I don't know. I suppose his background was different, and being Australian, they all tend to be a bit more chummy and a bit more matey, don't they, you know. I suppose that's what it was, but when I got to China, I don't think Burchett was in China when I got back, but he came up a few times, and I got to know him fairly well. I think I probably knew Winnington better than Burchett, but I always liked Burchett. He's a very... very straightforward person, very straight. Aaron, the difference between them is sometimes, I mean, I used to have discussions or arguments with him. Aaron Winnington was, he'd argue in a dialectical fashion, very carefully and very deliberately and analytically almost, you know, to prove his point. Burchett's approach to perhaps the same problem or the same argument would be probably more on a level that I'm thinking, you know, and more matter of fact and more or closer to reality. Whereas Winnington could sometimes produce abstract arguments or even abstruse arguments, which would be difficult to handle.
Did Wilfred Burchett perform the same role that Alan Winnington performed?
As far as I know, they were both, they were essentially two journalists, and they were covering the peace talks at Panmunjom and John. A lot has been written about it. They've both, I think, written books about it. Other people have written books about it.
But did they perform the same role in relation to the POWs in providing a channel for them?
Yes, Burchett did as well. Not to the same degree as Winnington, because perhaps he was... He visited the camps less often than Winnington, perhaps didn't at the time. But he also did, yeah.
Since the Korean War, they were treated virtually as traitors and had their passports withdrawn, I think. Did you feel that treatment was justified?
No, I did not, because I knew them both as men, as individuals. And although I didn't agree all the way down the line with their political viewpoints or ideas, I found them to be reasonable men, people who helped us in a difficult situation. And of course I didn't know much about what was happening at the time, but having read since then, it's obvious that during the peace talks in Panmunjom, that both Winnington and Burchett were a thorn in the sides of the American officers or the military who were conducting the negotiations. And they used to give stories to the American press and so on, which would then be published, which were not always favorable to the Americans, because the Americans would sometimes put down a blanket on information saying, you know, no results, nothing's been announced, and then Burchett and Winnington would then give them the transcript of the negotiations. So I think Winnington and Burchett were both victims of possibly the CIA or certainly the American military. Just that they just couldn't forget this. Again, it's a question of viewpoint, because they probably saw Winnington and Burchett both as communist devils, and these were just terrible men.
How did you come to decide to stay there in Korea?
Again, not an easy question to answer. Let's say that it's not an easy question to answer in a few sentences. That's what I mean. I can answer the question, but it would take a lot of time. I'll try to... take as little time about it as possible, try to summarize. My experience since capture and all the way through the prisoner of war camps and so on, as I say, A lot of the time it was a harsh experience, it was a difficult experience. In the sense that you're coming very close to death yourself, that you see your friends killed or dying around you, and you bury them, and that hurts, but you come inured, you become inured to that. I'd developed a political interest and an interest in ideas, I suppose, which I might have had before to a limited extent, but certainly my reading and my thinking and discussions with the other chaps and so on got me to thinking this way. But right up until the last minute, I had never any other idea in my head except to come home. Well, obvious. The first thing you want to do in a prisoner of war camp is get out, you know. And it wasn't until quite late in the day that the armistice negotiations, I think they fell over on this point about the return of prisoners, and then it was finally agreed to. And when we read about it, then I then thought, oh, why don't I take advantage of this? At first, just a thought, and didn't sort of actually last very long in my mind. But the more I sort of tossed the idea around in my head, I thought, well, that might be an idea, because I thought that, well, what... Although I've seen something of the Chinese, say, in the camp, I mean, the Koreans weren't much in my mind at this time, because I didn't have a lot to do with them. It was mainly the Chinese. I'd been quite impressed in many ways by them. They could be silly at times, of course, so could we. But I was quite impressed by their behavior towards us. They were quite friendly. I was quite interested in the ideas that Marxism, if you like, put forward as an answer to man's problems, basically. But of course I knew very well that what I've been reading about is the theory, and I wasn't foolish enough to believe that all theory is necessarily followed through by essentially the same in practice. And I thought, well, it might be an idea if I could go to China for a little while and just to see if the theory worked out in practice. And my initial idea was to go to China at the most for a year, 6 months to a year, something like that. If possible, then visit Russia on the way home. But I thought I'd be home within a year, say, at the most. That was my initial idea. Of course, then the question comes up, well, I'm still in the Royal Marines. But it didn't really bother me that much at the time. It didn't, you know, I thought, well, when I finally get back, I'll probably get into some trouble. But on the whole, as far as I could see it, I was doing nothing illegal. Under the terms of the armistice agreement, to which the British government of that time was a signatory, they gave me the option of coming home or staying. So I didn't feel that I was doing anything illegal or immoral or anything else. It was my decision, and I made it. A lot of people, of course, disagreed with that, obviously, but that was the way I saw it. But it wasn't terribly important to me. I can readily admit that there was perhaps also a touch of, especially China was a place that had always intrigued me in some ways. I dare say there was an element of romanticism in it, or adventurism, if you like, you know, doing this. So it was a mixture of things. The hardest thing I had to overcome was the fact of my family and how they'd take it, because I'd come from a rather close-knit family, and I had a large degree of apprehension about how they would accept this. Could they understand it? They couldn't possibly understand what I had been through, how I had changed. But there was nothing much I could do about that except just hope that as and when I saw them, I'd be able to explain it, which in fact, eventually I did. So it was a very complicated process of thinking, but on the whole, it was something I decided in a fairly short period of time. And when I first approached the Chinese on it, they disagreed. They didn't want me to stay. And as a matter of fact, there was a rather high-level Chinese officer who interviewed me about this, and he spoke to me on and off, not every day, but on and off for about 3 days, two or three times a week, trying to convince me that the best thing for me to do was come home and not to stay.
Why did he think that?
Because he said, well, life is still hard in China, and what are you going to do in China, and you'll have problems and all the rest of it. And surely it's better, after you've been a prisoner of war, your family's been worried about you, get back home to your family, and so on. Quite a reasonable argument. But the more and more he tried to convince me not to stay, the more and more convinced, the more and more stubborn I got and decided I would. I was not the only British. I was, in the end, the only one who stayed. But I was not at that time the only one. There was quite a number of people who wanted to stay. The Chinese told me this, but they talked to them and they convinced them not to, and none of them did. I was the only one that...
Did you know?
Depending on how you look at it, I was the only one who was stubborn enough or stupid enough, or the only one who stuck to his guns once he had made his decision. I don't know. Depends how you look at it.
Did you know any of the other British people who wanted to stay?
I knew a few in our camp, and there was also apparently some others in some other camps, but I certainly wouldn't want to name them. So in addition to myself, there was also a large group of Americans who wanted to stay, but they talked them out of it. In the end, well, I think it was 22 of them stayed, and myself as the one Briton. Of the 22 or the 23 who stayed, I'm not saying everyone stayed for the same reasons as I did. I can only give you my reasons. I cannot give you their reasons. Things have been written about them and so on, but...
Did you feel that you were a communist at that time?
No.
Or a Marxist?
I suppose I saw myself as a Marxist in a way. In other words, in my in the way that I attempted to analyze political or economic problems, I could say that I couldn't possibly be a convinced Marxist. I mean, I had only access to limited sort of resources and in a very odd situation, totally absorbed from reality, if you like. But a lot of my thinking was along that way, and I thought that perhaps it's a guide. It's a guide to an answer. Perhaps it's not the complete answer, but it may be. And this actually intrigued me. This did intrigue me.
So what exactly happened once they realized that you were going to go through with it? Mm-hmm. Did you go off to China?
No, we stayed in Korea for a while. The chaps were gradually in groups, sort of left the camps and went and were handed over to their own side. I remained behind in the camp. We stayed there for a week or two, and then we had to go to the whole group of us. We had to go to Panmunjom for so-called explanations, because part of the armistice agreement was that people who do decide to remain behind had to be given the chance for people of their own sides to talk to them, to determine whether or not they were making up their own minds or whether they were being forced or coerced into making this decision.
I remember as a boy of 11 seeing a group of probably American and British servicemen who had been POWs being asked if they really wanted to stay behind in Korea, and them all shouting out no. Mm. Were you amongst that group?
If they wanted to stay behind in Korea and shouting out no?
Yeah, and shouted out yes.
Shouted out yes. I must have been, if there were British included, I was the only Briton. So I must have been included in that group. I don't actually recall, doing that with cameras running, but it could well have been. Well, it must have been. If you saw a film of it, it must have been filmed.
That was at Panmunjom, was it?
At Panmunjom. Mm-hmm.
Then where did you go next after being processed at Panmunjom?
Well, the actual process of Panmunjom never came off because there was some kerfuffle, there was some mix-up and so on. We were never actually explained to individually. The closest we came, because we were put in charge of Indians. It was the Indian Army, and it was actually the first time I'd been behind barbed wire as a prisoner for almost 3 years, right at the hinder end of it. they had a compound set up. We were under Indian soldiers, under Indian guards. And I think there was once when some officers either came or it was a recording or something that was played over the loudspeaker system, explaining to us, you know, that we could go back, and we were free to go back, and that we wouldn't be put, no charges would be made against us, this, that, and the other thing. Two of the Americans did, two, I think. Batchelor was one, what was the other fellow's name? Can't remember. I think two of them from that compound decided to go back. Batchelor was sentenced to 25 years in jail. The other chap, Dickinson was the other one. He got about 10 years in jail or something like that. But as far as I recall, they were the only two that went back from Pam and John. And so gradually we were released from the custody of the Indians, and we went back, and the Chinese were there, of course. We stayed in Permanjohn for a couple of weeks, and I think we got some civilian clothes and things, shoes and things like that. And then we got on the train, and we headed for that River Jordan into China.
And how did you find it there in practice?
More or less as I expected. I was... standards there, of course, were, obviously low by Western standards, but I had gone through a process as a prisoner of war in Korea where perhaps my standards had been greatly lowered. You know, if I'd gone there straight from Britain, I would have probably found things rather tough, because China is still a poor country, and it was poorer still then. But there was a certain, at that time, there was a certain exuberance and a feeling among people that one met. Of course, I couldn't communicate with them. I could speak no Chinese. In the prisoner of war camps, the Chinese refused to teach us any Chinese at all. Some of the chaps wanted to try and learn Chinese. The Chinese refused. They just wouldn't make any attempt to teach them. Obviously, we picked up words like good morning and goodbye and things like that, but they would dissuade people from learning Chinese. They didn't have to. If there's nobody to teach them, they couldn't learn. A few might have learned a few sentences, but that was about it. So we got to China not knowing any Chinese, and so we were totally dependent upon the Chinese to interpret for us. And as I say, I found there was a certain air of, it wasn't, let's face it, it wasn't all that long after the end of the revolution, or what they call the liberation. Chinese always refer to 1949 as liberation. And in daily conversations, they will always date things in that way, you know, before the liberation, after the liberation, and so on. It's a point in time for them, like us would be Second World War. We'd speak before or after the Second World War, so it was a point in time for them. I found Chinese people very friendly and hard-working, and one tended to, I don't know, it was a very happy and convivial atmosphere. And I've often thought since then, I was fortunate in going to China at that time, and I stayed in China then for another, 8 or 9 years, thereabouts. And I always felt that I was lucky and fortunate.